You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show, considered the hottest podcast in the universe. Now get ready for the heat. Here's Brian Callen.
Yeah, here you are on The Brian Callen Hunter Mott Show. Let me start by saying we have Lawrence Krauss on the show. He is a theoretical physicist and cosmologist. I don't even know what the hell that is. I know you deal with abstract mathematical models. I like awards. More importantly, you are... You are, I guess, the only physicist to have received rewards from all three major U.S. physics societies, the American Physical Society, the American Association of Physics Teachers, and the American Institute of Physics, and you're a critic of string theory. Either way, I don't know what the hell you're talking about half the time. I've read your stuff. I've listened to your awesome debates with religious people. And I'm just really, I have so many questions.
Oh, dear.
I know. Okay. Well, let me just start by saying that what I really appreciate about you is the fact that you, I don't think scientists take the debate to the public enough. I think that we are, as you said, if you don't understand how science works, you're illiterate. And it's to our detriment. And you've done, you are tireless in really... taking on the mythologies, the religions that are such a strong basis of our entire, just the fabric of our societies and our belief systems.
Yeah, unfortunate.
Yeah, but it takes a lot of courage, and I appreciate it, and I'm glad
thanks.
You're here, man. Yeah, because you.
Well,
you know.
it's important, obviously, I think, but it's also it's necessary and actually enjoyable. I enjoy getting outside the university and talking to people, and it seems to me if you're going to part of the effort as an educator is if you're going to sort of try and create knowledge without disseminating it, it's kind of useless. I mean, and science and reason should be out much closer to the rest of our culture. I mean, people for some reason are intimidated by science and are perfectly willing to say they're ignorant about it, as you have done so well today.
Yeah.
But in fact, you know, it's weird because they don't feel they can enjoy science and the fantastic things that are happening in the universe. You don't have to be a musician to enjoy music or a writer to enjoy drama. And I think that you don't have to be a scientist to enjoy science. In fact, I think it's essential that since it's such a central part of our lives, that we at least appreciate. You don't have to know how to, you know, build a computer to at least appreciate the amazing things we're learning about the universe. Anyway, that's a little too profound.
But no, it's not, because it's exactly what, to your point, what I love about you, what you say, really, in a lot of your lectures is, hey, listen, you got the Bible, you've got the Quran, you've got the Bhagavad Gita, whatever it might be. If you take a look at actually what science is unfolding, and if you take a look at what we are learning, the story of science, where science is pointing to, the number of galaxies and universes, that's way more mind-blowing, way more exciting than anything written in a book 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 years ago.
I mean, people who didn't even know the Earth orbited the sun. Absolutely. I mean, the real universe is so amazing. You don't need all the garbage. The real universe is more awesome, and in fact, I would argue, is more spiritually uplifting. It's because, well, not least because it's real. And that's what we should be celebrating. And it's the stories of all of the scriptures of all the world's religions are kind of tame and silly and also obscene often. I mean, you know, people...
I beg your pardon, sir.
Well,
what's wrong with obscene?
No, but I mean, you know, we talk sometimes, it's clear that they, of course, the Bible and the rest of the scriptures that don't, you know, are inconsistent with what we know about the universe now. The scientific aspect of them is nonsense. But we don't often point out that, you know, people say that's fine because the Bible's a guide on how to live. Well, certainly you wouldn't want to live like in the Bible. It's obscene.
Yeah, just read Deuteronomy. They weren't the nicest people in the world.
Yeah.
No. Absolutely. I kind of feel cheated. You know, I grew up in a, you know, I was bar mitzvahed and all the rest, and I was sort of told that, you know, David and Solomon were all these great guys, and then you read about them, they were genocidal criminals.
Yeah, they weren't very friendly to those that didn't take God as their Lord. Israelites were pretty rough on some of the people of, I think, the Valley of Baal, and Deuteronomy is a hard
No, man. I mean, you know, to be fair, everyone else may have been equally crappy.
Sure,
but
yeah, of course.
Certainly were. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. No, but let me challenge you a little bit on this. You know, you I think that sometimes guys like yourself and Dawkins and stuff tend to look at religion in sort of you are assuming that people have if not a fundamentalist notion of what God is, then a very constructed notion, a tangible notion. I think that religion can also be, I think human beings need a couple of things. One is inspiration. You can listen to a piece of music that makes you feel sad and joyous at the same time. There's a great deal of mystery to life. We love mystery. I live for mystery. I don't want to reduce human beings to mathematical biology. I don't want to think
but
of somebody...
science is full of mystery. I know where you're heading, and I want to go there, but the one thing I want to object to is people somehow suggest that science is it full of mystery?
Right.
Science is all about mystery. Science is all about not knowing. It's all about trying to learn. It's not about what we already know. It's how to ask questions and the amazing questions that we still don't understand. So while I agree with you, I think where you're heading, and we'll go there, I really don't want people to think that science is dry and just a set of facts. Mm. Science is about mystery. Sorry, go on.
That's a very good point.
Isn't a large part of that, though, the way that science is taught in high schools?
Of course.
I mean, you know.
Of course, because the science teachers, unfortunately, for the most part, many of them are uncomfortable with science. And therefore, you know, what we really should be doing is teaching kids how to ask questions. But many of the teachers, in fact, I think I once, wrote a piece when I did a study, it was, I think about almost 90% of middle school science teachers in this country didn't have any real training in science. And so if you're uncomfortable with science, what you tend to do is teach to the curriculum, right? You don't want to go to open-ended questions. But that's really what science is all about, is asking questions and going up. But you can only do that if you're relatively comfortable with the material. And you're absolutely right. We turn kids off and think it's just a bunch of facts. It's not. It's a process about how we understand the world.
This is true. And you hear mathematicians who come up with these amazing theorems and they're obsessed with it their whole life. And 150 years later, it might just come. It turns out to actually bear some relevance to the physical world. And there are lots of wonderful things. Obviously, nobody wants to live in a world without science. I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, I don't know that I want you describing and explaining what romance is to me or those kinds of things, even laughter. I mean, I'm a stand-up comic. I can break down. I think laughter is probably, I'm able to surprise you. I get you going one way and I do another thing. But I don't know if I want you showing me all the machinations behind the magic trick. That's not to say I would censor a scientist, my God. But I just, I think that the human, your resistance comes from people who say, wait a minute. There are things which we cannot measure and probably will never be able to measure. There is this notion of communion, a humble communion with your own soul, in terms of the universe is so awe-inspiring. It's so big. There is so much. It's an ocean. Even Newton was religious. You know, maybe because it was like sort of going, there's got to be some order to this insanity.
Okay, there's a lot of things you just said. By the way, Newton was not only religious, he spent most of his time on theology and the rest of his time on alchemy and just a little teeny bit on physics.
Isn't that crazy? Yeah. I know, the father of science.
He was a crazy man.
I know.
But And when people say that, by the way, the other thing to often point out is that you had to be kind of religious back then. I mean, it was the church was the Rockefeller Foundation of the, you know, from the 15th century on. I mean, it was the only source of money and education. And
sure.
So you had to buy that. But your point, look, is well taken, that being human is many different things, and no one wants to reduce the experience of being human or the fact that as you started to say earlier before I interrupt you. Religion, for many people, does provide a sense of community and sharing and all of those other things. But the point is that you don't need religion for that. The community that we clearly crave that. Religion, because it's been ubiquitous throughout human history, clearly satisfies some cultural or even maybe biological needs that humans have. Hmm. But the question is, we should try and address what are those needs and how can we address them? And, you know, we can have a sense of community, as I often say, by having a nice rock concert every Sunday and instead of a church service.
Hmm.
I think we can meet many of the good things that religion provides without the need for this sort of false story. And you might say, why? What does it really matter? And the answer is that, well, it doesn't really matter what people believe at some level. But if they believe things that are not in accord with reality, it causes them to do things that are irrational. that
like kill people, like kill people for a belief that doesn't have any grounding.
Or flying planes in a building, or condemning gay people. You know, I mean, if you do things that are clearly against empirical evidence, like the claim that being gay is unnatural, when, as I've often pointed out, basically all mammalian species have about 10% gay members, and sheep actually have long-term gay relationships.
Really? Sheep do?
I think,
that's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, you know, some of them. And so I don't think they're being evil or you know, it's clearly biological, but the claim that that's unnatural just is wrong. And when you, if you somehow, if your religion tells you that, so you act that way and you want to discriminate, it leads you to actions, to inappropriate actions. So it's really more the fact that these distortions lead people to inappropriate actions that bothers me. As far as taking away, you know, talking about how laughter works or whatever, I'm not 100% certain that it really gets in the way. The physicist Richard Feynman used to say that, you know, knowing how a rainbow works doesn't make it any less beautiful. In mm-hmm. fact, in some
sure.
ways,
sure.
it makes it more beautiful.
That's right. That's right.
And so I don't, in general, I think because, you know, just knowing how something happens doesn't take the joy away from it. We're human beings. We experience things in many different ways, rationally, emotionally, and otherwise. And I don't think our knowledge is going to reduce it. And in fact, even if it does, you have to ask the question: should we be afraid of knowing just because it might?
No,
well,
of course
really,
not.
That's
of
really
course
bad.
Not. Yeah. But let me ask you this: you know, we have had societies where religion doesn't play a role. The worry that I have is that human beings...
Not many.
Well, I mean, I think the Communist Revolution and even the Nazi Revolution in some ways
I don't think... I think the Nazi thing is a little bit wrong.
Yeah, it is. It's not a fair... Yeah, it's not a fair assumption.
Yeah.
It's, you're right.
And people often claim it.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. But let me ask you this. I worry that without the moral teachings of some kind of this notion of a higher power that's then been written down into a book that can then be kind of where people can congregate around these commandments or whatever you might have. I wonder then how we are supposed to, as a society, teach our children and people that I do believe people have a moral sense to an extent, but I feel as though the contributions, for example, of the Judeo-Christian ethic, let's just take that. I think one of the biggest contributions is, hey, let's just take the Torah and then finally the New Testament. One of the things I think I appreciate about the Old Testament, as you giggle, is this. This is a radical notion. Look, we are all of the same moral worth. We all come from one father. That's a very strong and resilient philosophy.
Well, hold on a second. I'm not sure that's the message that it gives. That's the message you may have taken. The message it gives is that there are certain chosen people, and the rest of the people, you know, aren't, and either get killed or go to hell.
Yeah.
Well,
so I think it does the exact opposite of what you're saying. It separates us into us and them. And us, we're going to be saved, or we have the right to kill, and the rest of the people, you know, can perish.
But we don't have a society based on our system of law. Our system of law is based on the idea that we're all of the same moral worth.
That's the point. What I was going to get at. I'm going to keep interrupting. By the way,
you're smarter. You're allowed to.
Okay, but you know, you just said, how can we have a moral fiber? Well, our laws aren't based on the Bible. Hmm. We have a code of conduct that's based on a constitution and a legal system. And that's how we determine, in fact, what, you know, as a society, what we think is right and wrong.
But it came from religion, didn't it? Didn't it come from Christianity?
Nah,
didn't the founding fathers,
nah.
weren't the founding fathers?
No, many of the founding fathers, including Thomas Jefferson, and certainly Benjamin Franklin, didn't believe in God.
Well, they were deists.
The claim
that we're a Christian
nation is one of these myths that's been pervaded by the religious right.
That is true, but they were steeped in religion. They were deists. A lot of them said there's
Brian,
a higher power.
Brian,
and the idea is there's got to be a benevolent direction for humans.
No, like,
but the founding fathers talked a lot
about... They were also steeped in the modern humanists. They were, they based the Constitution and the Bill of Rights on the philosophers, on the humanists who were arguing, you know, the very same thing you're talking about, that, you know, people have inalienable rights, et cetera, et cetera. So, of course, all of that is in our cultural background. But to argue that religion is a necessary part of this, as I've said in a variety of events, you know, I said to people, okay, if you stop believing in God, would you go out and kill your neighbor right away? And only in one case did I have an audience.
the sociopath.
But in that case, the neighbor was a real dick and had trimmed his hedges a little too much,
But anyway, so I think it's not necessary. I think on the whole, the things that you think are right or wrong have nothing to do with the Bible. Mm.
And beyond that, I mean, that's the point. In terms of that moral equality that you're attributing to Judeo-Christian ethic, it's in the Declaration of Independence. All men are created equal. That's the basis. And I think the problem is that a lot of these ideas were tested and developed under the context of religion. But what happened with the Enlightenment is that those ideas, which had been found to be principles that worked for the construction of a society, then they realized that the religious element was no longer needed for that idea to provide the right kind of societal structure.
Well, I don't know.
And the religious element could provide whatever you wanted. All men were created equal. It was fine today, but as you know, we had slaves, just like they had slaves in Israel and in Egypt and everywhere else. And so I think the point is that the ideas and the actions are different. The religion can be used to basically justify whatever power structure you want to create. But you're absolutely right. I think that the forefathers particularly specifically said, these ideas are good ideas, whether they come from the Bible or from the Enlightenment, but we don't need a state religion to enforce them. In fact, they've very strongly said exactly the opposite. Although, there's many people, by the way, who suggest that one of the reasons that the fundamentalists are so strong in this country is because we don't have a state religion. If we had one, like the Church of England, it just gets lazy, right? It's capitalism versus socialism. It's, you know, the mega churches have to be entrepreneurial in order to survive. They're not guaranteed state survival, and by being entrepreneurial, they're more successful. So some people have argued that, you know, we'd be better off with a state church because then we could all ignore it, like the Anglicans in England.
what I love about what you said, and I'm playing devil's advocate here with you, because what I love about what you said is that what's great about science is there is no authority. Authority is data and measuring reality and being able to replicate those experiments and those models. That's the reality, isn't it? I mean, when Galileo and Copernicus came along with their theorems and things and said, guess what? The Earth revolves around the sun, and they were branded heretics and stuff like that. Well, the truth is that that's a mathematical reality, and that's
a physical reality.
It's a physical reality.
In fact, and you're absolutely right. The only I've said it, and there are no scientific authorities. That's really important. There's no one whose words are not subject to criticism and skepticism and critical evaluation. The only authority is ultimately nature, because nature tells you, nature tells you whether it's going to work or not. You can say, you know what, gravity doesn't exist, but then go out and walk outside the window of the 10th floor and you'll find out the answer.
Exactly. But let me ask you something you said that I thought was very interesting. You know, so I've always heard that science is the study of causation. It is the study of causes. However, one of your theses or one of the things you talk about is that there doesn't have to be a cause. This is so radical to me, because when you talk about the universe coming from nothing and you talk about, dark matter what you define what nothing is. And you've been criticized for, you're using it semantics, and we know what nothing is, and you're blah, blah, blah.
They're experts at nothing, the theologians and philosophers.
Pulling no punches, Krauss, professor. Anyway, but that was very interesting to me. Explain that a little bit, professor, because, you know, I always thought that everything has to have a cause. There's a mover. There's the first mover everything.
Yeah, that's the point. I mean, the prime mover, first cause, all of those things are essential part of various theologies. And the point is that because you always thought something had to happen doesn't mean it had to happen. And that's a really important thing about science, is that our intuition is often wrong. Because as my friend Richard Dawkins says in this movie that's just coming out of us, we evolved in the savannah and the Pleistocene to escape lions and to learn how, find food, not to understand quantum mechanics or relativity and the actual universe. And so therefore what we determine as our common sense is based on those things that we experience on our level on a daily basis. But the great thing about science is it removes that myopia. It says, well, that's fine, but that's not the way the world necessarily has to behave. What you think is sensible may not be, in fact, the way the world works. And just determining or deciding in advance that the world has to work that way because only that way is sensible is nonsense. You've got to go out and find out. And often We're surprised. That's how science opens our minds. And even the idea of cause and effect may ultimately, because have to if we're trying to understand the very beginning of the universe, because as I describe in the book, it's quite likely. In fact, our universe has the properties of a universe that could have been created from nothing by standard laws of physics without any supernatural shenanigans. But if you apply quantum mechanics to gravity, it suggests that you can create universes from nothing. That means spaces and times, because space.
It's so mind blowing. It's so mind. I tried to follow you on it. It's so mind. I can't. I wish.
It is mind blowing.
I wish I knew.
It is. It's the limits of our imagination, but the universe forces us towards those limits. That's what's so exciting about science. But anyway, space and time are coupled. So if space is created and time is created, then there was no before the Big Bang. Now that may not. We can't say that for certain. And I want to stress that we don't have a theory of T equals zero yet. We don't have a full quantum theory of gravity, but we do know what the properties of that theory would be. And if space-time was created, then certainly time itself may have arisen out of the Big Bang. And the question, what was before the Big Bang, is simply not a good question. And if there's no before, mm-hmm. if you try and think about cause, then you're going to have problems. So we have to force ourselves to change our thinking at times, including what our thinking about nothing is. And that's, you know, that's not a bad thing. That's called learning.
Okay, you're a critic of string theory. I wish I could be like, I don't really believe in string. I don't even know what the hell. I tried to learn what string theory is. My idea is that there are different there are basically molecules on different strings, like a guitar.
Yeah, it's right. Don't worry about string theory. It's not really important.
I love him. And you know what I appreciate about you, and correct me if I'm wrong, as I watch it, you look like you're actually in shape. You're not like just some scientist who sits at a computer. You actually look like you work out. You're kind of a big, you look like a strong guy.
I worked out for 2 hours this morning. Yeah,
yes.
That's what I'm talking about.
That's a man right there.
That's right.
He can outrun you and out-wrestle you.
Man. And out-think you.
And
I was a wrestler I was a wrestler way back when.
So was I. I love you. I love it. You have a problem with him?
I could take you down 5 seconds.
Listen, man, I'll sprawl on you real quick, my friend.
Brian has a huge welt on his head because he tried to wrestle with Brendan Schaub, the MMA fighter.
Yeah, I'm literally 46 and I'm still rolling around like an idiot. Anyway, it's so humbling. But what's more humbling is I can just imagine thinking in the space that you do. You know, I sit around thinking about ways to make people laugh, and I love doing it. But there seems to be so much creativity in, I guess, the kind of mindset you have to have. For example, you know, Lauren, Professor, you're talking about, I mean...
Lawrence is fine.
I know, but I like calling you Professor. It's just fun. I think you've earned it.
In that case, it's Hair Doctor Professor.
That's even better. When you talk about like bending universes and different kinds of universes and different, can you explain that, please, in layman's terms? Can you please explain what the hell you're talking about and what you think reality is? I've heard that it's a hologram. We're all living in this big hologram. What the hell is going on?
You want me to explain what I'm talking about? How should I know?
Exactly.
Well, look, we don't know the ultimate. Of course, that's what we keep trying to find out. But it's quite likely, on the basis of everything we know now, that it seems reasonable to think that our universe is not unique, that there are many universes. And some of them may have different laws of physics than ours. Most of our ideas about elementary particle physics, including string theory, but not just unique to string theory, suggest that you know, there are many universes. There may be universes being created right now that are, all of them are sort of causally disconnected from us. And so we can't experience them directly, but there may be many, many different universes. And there are ideas from string theory, which are interesting, but again, not clearly relevant to our universe as far as we know yet, that suggests that maybe, they're mathematically, you might be, that the idea of dimensionality, it might be an illusion that you, like a hologram, when you look at a hologram, of course, you look in there and you see a three-dimensional image, but it's just a two-dimensional plate, right? You know, the hologram is like a photograph, but it contains all the three-dimensional information.
Yeah.
So the suggestion from some ideas that are based in string theory is that you may be able to contain all the information of a four-dimensional universe on its surface. Somehow all that information be coded, and so there's a a connection between different dimensions. And it's all very nice mathematically in certain limits, but we don't know if that has anything to do with our universe. It's useful at times to actually help you solve certain mathematical problems by recasting them in a form that seems simpler. So a certain problem in involving gravity in a certain number of dimensions might be recast in another form in terms of a theory you could understand in a different number of dimensions. So mathematically it allows us to solve problems that we might not be able to solve, which is fascinating. But whether it has to do with the real physical universe we live in terms of the number of dimensions of our universe and everything else is just an open question at this point.
And isn't this so much of why the conversation between, you know, particularly theoretical physicists and cosmologists and the general public break down is simply because the general public doesn't have the mathematics to really be able to engage with this in any real sort of way. And the result is that you end up trying to find imperfect physical analogies for this that a layman can appreciate.
Well, we always find imperfect physical analogies because even among physicists, because, you know, we're classical beings and the world is quantum mechanical, so we try and understand the quantum mechanical world using classical analogies. But you're right that at a certain level, the mathematics, if you want to accurately describe what's going on, you need a mathematical description. But they're not perfectly accurate. But I don't think that's as much of a problem as people claim. I think it scares people because they say, I can't possibly understand it because I don't have the mathematics. But I think, in fact, that in terms of the general characteristics of what's going on, we can, if we try hard enough, can explain things in a way that anyone can understand if you're willing to just at least think about it. And I don't want to pick on you, but I will. You know, when you said at the beginning, it sort of boggles my mind, and that, you know, I periodically read reviews of my books when I'm in a weak moment, and a good review of a science book reads like, boy, it boggled my mind. It just was amazing. I couldn't understand it, but it boggled my mind. That's a great review. But we don't accept that kind of argument. Can you imagine a review in the New Yorker or somewhere like that of an economics book or a political history book where the guy says, boy, that, you know, political history, I didn't understand it, but it just boggled my mind.
Yeah, you're right.
And so I think we're willing to allow people to say, look, I just can't possibly understand it. I'm not even going to try.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these ideas are complex, but we don't suggest that people should apply the same effort to try and understand them because they just think they can't understand.
Well,
them.
And they're letting.
And of course, at some basic level, you know, at some detailed level, you can't. But that's true of many areas. I mean, a Bach fugue is, you know, if you have to be, you know, if you're some kind of musician, you understand on a level that I'll never be able to understand it.
But that's why people like you are so important, because you're bringing it to people. What I suggest is this. For example, I think a lot of people don't realize, and I didn't realize for a long time, when somebody measures the circumference of the Earth. To me, I can't imagine how you do that until I heard that essentially what Newton did was he used models. He used reductionist methods to do that.
Actually, the Greeks knew how to measure the circumference of the Earth. It's pretty easy.
Give me an example.
2,000 years ago.
How do you do
it? Well, all you have to do is go to Alexandria and look at June 21st, look at the solstice. The sun is right, you know, if you're near the equator, the sun is right above you. Mm. And you can see that because you look down a deep well and there's the image of the sun. You know, it's right above you.
Right.
But if you went 100 miles away, the shadow of the sun, if you look at a well, actually comes at a little bit of an angle. And a Greek scientist realized, well, that's because the Earth is curved. And in one at the equator, the sun is right above it. But if the Earth is curved somewhere else, the sun is at an angle.
Wow.
And by measuring that angle and measuring that distance, he was able to work out the circumference of the Earth over 2,000 years ago.
That's there it is. That's what needs to be. That kind of stuff makes total sense to me. I don't have to be a mathematician to understand that concept.
The principle.
Yeah, the principle.
Yeah.
But that also goes so much back to, you know, how physics is taught. It's taught as a series of facts. It's not taught, as Professor Krauss said, as a series of questions. Mm. Right? And so you don't I remember, because, you know, I majored in biochemistry. And so, you know, in high school you learn very much like, you know, DNA is like this, and, you know, RNA is like this. And then in college, you get the experience of actually finding out, here are the first experiments. From this, they conclude this, which raises a whole new series of questions. And then you have
Also, sorry, go on.
Well, and then you have to figure out. I mean, I think that what's so much of the beauty of science is the design of the experiment. It is incredibly, it requires a lot of thought to design an experiment that answers only the question that you're asking and that answers it unequivocally. And some of the classic experiments in science, I mean, you know, I know the ones in biology best, but they are gorgeous. They are really works of art. And I mean, in terms of having that sublime experience that you're talking about, that transcendent experience, I mean, you know, look at, you know, Meselson and Stahl or any of those like really definitive experiments and you will have that experience.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, again, you can describe those experiments and appreciate them. But I think your point that really these things, what kids are taught is a set of facts that they're supposed to take on faith,
mm-hmm.
as if, just like the Bible.
That's
and it's
right.
all like, you know, energy, you know, it's conserved. Okay, well, someone said that, so I have to believe that. And they don't understand that there are reasons for that. It's not that we like that. It's not that Einstein said something and then where we all bow down to it. It's the fact that we can test the idea and there are fundamental reasons for that. And so it's not that and the really important thing is, how did these facts come about? How did we uncover these strange things about the universe? Not that the facts exist, because after all, for most people, they won't need to know most of the facts.
Mm-hmm.
And what they really need to know, if they want to be productive in their lives, is the kind of processes that allow us to tell sense from nonsense,
mm-hmm.
and how to take a complicated system and try and analyze it in a way that at least gives you some idea of what's going on. And those are the useful tools that we need to teach.
Well, we benefit. I always say to people, look, man, we live in Los Angeles, okay, where people go to psychics and will tell you what their sign is and actually to believe in this stuff. And then you look and they're using a cell phone. You think to yourself, you couldn't live without your cell phone. And the science that went into that cell phone, the science that went into that pushes you beyond your biology, from the CAT scan you have to the antibiotics to the anesthesia, all those things are the result of empirical thought processes and experimentation and trial and error and the ethos that they're under the authority of no one. We are going to keep reassessing.
And it's inconsistent. I mean, the other thing I would say is, young Earth people or the people who, you know, buy astrology, if you use a cell phone or use a computer or use a toaster or drive in a car, you're being a hypocrite.
Exactly.
Because the very things that those things are based on tells you that this stuff is nonsense.
Yeah, it's a rebuttal to that stuff.
I don't want to, and it sounds patronizing to say it, but it's absolutely true, especially the younger people are complete hypocrites. But the point is, we all have that ability to accept completely inconsistent notions. We do it every day. We all tell ourselves imaginary stories about our work or our family or whatever just to get up in the morning.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's not too surprising that people can accept things that are, you know, that have this dichotomy between reality and what they want. And so, but it's nice to remind people, I think, and it's important to remind people that they are inconsistent. And that's what, you know, and I think it's true with the Bible too. It's important to point out, of course, people want to believe. And I know scientists who, you know, who are religious in one or another. And it's fine, but it's worth pointing out that the two things are inconsistent, nevertheless.
Are you an optimist, or I mean, I know you're a skeptic, obviously, but are you an optimist? And if so, why? I know that there's so much to learn, but it's a good question because I think usually optimism is usually tied in with this idea that at the end of the day, this is all going to be for something good and great. We're being nudged together, and there's going to be some kind of a, I guess.
Well, it depends on the day whether an optimist. A good friend of mine is a very famous writer, said to me once, who writes very dark stories, and I mentioned his name, but it's name dropping.
Go ahead.
Drop the name.
No, he's a wonderful. He's actually in our movie, Cormac McCarthy.
Oh, I love.
Oh my God!
My favorite book is Blood Meridian. My God!
And in any case, you know, when I first met him, he's, you know, his books are very dark, and he's a very chipper guy. And I said, you know, I'm amazed you're so chipper. He said, well, you know, I'm a pessimist, but that's no reason to be gloomy.
Wow. That's amazing.
I try and hope that things can work out. That's a true statement. Nevertheless, I know the future is miserable as far as the universe is concerned.
Yeah.
And as my ex-wife once said, it's going to get worse before it gets worse.
The universe, from what I've gathered from your writings and stuff, the universe is expanding. We are kind of being left. It's going to get pretty dark and pretty cold eventually.
Yeah,
on this
but,
earth.
But not. Yeah, eventually. You don't have to sell your Microsoft stock right now, although I would sell it. But we're talking the universe in the long term, and I'm talking hundreds of billions or trillions of years from now, is going to become cold, dark, and empty. Everything we can now see is going to disappear from us. I mean, it's going to be a pretty miserable place. So as my other friend, who was writing the foreword for my last book, but unfortunately died before he could finish it, Christopher Hitchens, used to say, you know, when I was talking about something, nothing, he said, the simplest answer to the question, why is there something rather than nothing, is, when I explained this to him, he said, the simplest answer is to the question, why is there something rather than nothing, is, well, just wait, there won't be for long.
wow. But I always say, you know, it is fun to say kind of what is this all for? We are evolving as a people in the sense that our understanding is becoming deeper. And I think we're living in a time when our technology is expanding exponentially and our understanding of how things work from the brain to the universe is rapidly increasing, it feels. That suggests to me that there is momentum towards some kind of a goal, some kind whether we mesh with machines.
Well, there's progress. It's called, again, it's called learning. Science, there's progress. We have learned more about the universe, and we know more today than we did yesterday. But it's not as if it was that progress was either preordained or it's heading in some particular direction. It's just we are learning more, and as we learn more, we can do more. But you're saying
there doesn't have to be an end. To what end is what I would ask.
There doesn't have to be an end. There certainly doesn't have to be an end, and there doesn't have to be a purpose to it. We are hardwired to think there's there's purpose to things.
I am.
The heart is created so it can pump blood. Well, that already sounds. You know, these philosophers would call it teleologically. It sounds like. You know, but the heart wasn't created because it could pump blood. It wasn't created, okay? The system evolved, and one of the functions of the heart ended up being to pump blood. But there wasn't some purpose, you know, that said, oh, we need a heart now to pump blood. Okay?
But it's not all chaos. There is order. I mean, there is
order.
Yeah.
There is order, and although the universe tends in general to a state of disorder, and life is remarkable in the sense of being able to store energy, to harness energy, to create order, and that's one of the things that makes life interesting.
And understanding,
If we didn't have this ready source of energy, which allows us to build up order, then of course we not only could we not live, but the system would eventually, you know, decay and disorder as you can see for almost any other system. So there is order, there is progress, and in fact we have a brain that allows us to interpret the universe rationally, and we can actually try and make the world a better place. And my point is that to do that we can base our actions and our public policies on empirical evidence and rational thought. And if we do that, we can make the world a better place instead of basing it on 2,000-year-old books that were written by ignorant peasants.
I beg your pardon, sir. Moses was an Egyptian prince.
But there again, Brian, is
he didn't write the book.
That's true. That's all right. All right, you're getting all detailed on me now, Professor.
But there again is the mystery that you're looking for, Brian. Like the point is that our brains are hardwired to find narratives and story, and you know, in the biological context, people are always like, you know, people turn evolution into a story, you know, where humans are better and you know, other species are worse. And that's not the case. You know, humans are better adapted to certain environments, and you know, the whelk is well adapted to other environments,
right?
But the thing is that you know, once you push past those simple narratives and you get down to the reality of how the universe actually works, it is full of mystery, and it is full of, you know, things that defy our comprehension because they don't fit within the easy narratives that we create on a sort of intuitive level.
Yeah, but Professor, what I get hung up on, and I appreciate that you're right, but Professor, what I get hung up on is, human beings have what separates us from animals, in fact, is one word: potential.
We are animals.
But there's a big difference between us and a muskox, and this is it. And it's this: we have potential to do incredible things and go far beyond, really, even probably our own biology. Let me give you an example. When we can reverse engineer the brain and we can download our memories and our essence and our thoughts into a computer, what's that say about mortality? I'm quoting Ray Kurzweil.
Any questions?
Yeah.
I think consciousness is an amazing, and I think probably many animals have consciousness at different levels, but the consciousness, human consciousness, is a remarkable remarkable evolutionary development. And you're right, it does give us the potential to do things. In fact, there's a again, referring to the movie we're in, there's a wonderful scene where Richard says exactly that. Humans, we should take back the words intelligent design, because nature doesn't have it. Evolution doesn't have it. Evolution can't plan, can't stop a species from going extinct. It can't look into the future. That's not how evolution works, although people tend to think of it that way because life seems so well adapted to its environment. But it doesn't work that way. The only thing that can plan for the future is our brains. And it's an amazing, amazing gift that we have a consciousness that can allow us to plan for the future, have foresight, and try and avoid calamity and make things better. And it is a remarkable gift, and we should utilize it as much as possible.
Mm. You know, I know you're from Canada, and I am from. Are you? By the way, are you going to be? Are you? Do you live in Toronto?
No, I live in Arizona.
Oh, Arizona, right.
I grew up in Toronto, but that was many, many years ago.
Listen to me. I'm going to be in Tempe, Arizona, doing stand-up in 2 weeks. Will you come to my show? I will put you on my list. What are you doing?
I would love to come to your show, but I will be in Australia.
Blow off Australia, man. Come on. Come on, it's laughs.
Listen, you don't want to be upside down.
I wish. Too bad. Too
I'm
bad.
There a lot. It helps my brain work. Yeah, the blood flows that way.
Yeah, exactly.
Listen,
exactly.
How do you think he gets those abs? It's all inversion sit-ups, you know?
That's exactly right. Wait, I had a question about...
I'm sorry, because I love stand-up comedy. I'd love to do it another time, but unfortunately...
No worries.
When are you going to be here so you can advertise it on your program?
I'll be there December, I think it's 19th. Hold on. I'm so hopeless.
No. I have to go to Australia.
You got
to
go to Australia. All right.
You
got
to go have Christmas on the beach.
with the Barbie. I will be having a warm Christmas in Australia, and then I'll be.
Yeah.
You'll be having Chinese food on Christmas.
You'll
be having Chinese food on Christmas.
Yeah, right.
I used to do that. Yeah. Of course, like all good Jews. But I'll be celebrating a nice Christmas in Australia.
Oh, good.
That sounds great. It's it must be so much fun, though, just to wrestle with these, at least to, I was just thinking about in my country, in the United States, you don't get elected.
That's my country.
Okay, yeah, well, I'll give it to you. Yeah, all right.
Are you sure?
He's originally from Toronto, but yeah. He's
no,
now...
No, but I grew up, you know, I want you to know I was born in New York City, so I could be president.
Oh, there
okay.
you go.
Good.
Well, but, and speaking of president, though, you wouldn't get elected in this country because because as a president, you've got to say... To the that we live in a Christian nation. You've got to say Jesus Christ is God, and I believe.
Well, at least you got to believe in God. You got to play the God game.
You got to go to church.
It's more likely that we would elect a Muslim president than an atheist president.
That's true. That's very true. That's very true.
That's unfortunate.
Have you read Karen Armstrong's book, A Case for God?
I have no. I haven't been able to bring myself to read it. I've read the reviews of it, but I love
how you just don't apologize. You pull no punches, man. But you're so listen, people. I'm still not convinced there isn't something a great benevolent force out there. I'm still not convinced that all of this is moving us in a direction we should be moving in. I choose to believe that. Blah blah blah. I'm covering my ears. but I think you're. You know, obviously, you're so important. People like you for the long debate.
But I think that's so much.
Well, if you ask for my prejudice rather than my rational thing, and so I'll put on my prejudice hat. I feel exactly the opposite. I feel exactly the same as my late friend Christopher Richards. I wouldn't call myself an atheist in the sense that I cannot definitively say with absolute certainty that there's no some purpose or intelligence in the universe. There's just no evidence for it. But I can't say that with certainty. What I can say with certainty is I wouldn't want to live in a universe with one.
Hmm. Really?
I mean, I wouldn't want to live in a universe with a cosmic Saddam Hussein who is pulling the strings.
Huh.
That seems to me far less enjoyable than living in a universe where you can actually make your own future and you can create your own worth and your own meaning. That, to me, enlivens me and uplifts me and encourages me to do my best.
And, you know, as you're talking about, I'm thinking about Craig Venter, who's got, you know, his team that created synthetic biology. We're going to be able to control our own evolution in the foreseeable future, aren't we?
Well, we already do to some extent. Of course, we already do, and we will do more. And Craig's you know, I'm bored of my Origins project here, and we'll be at an event here in April that we're doing on potentially redesigning humans.
That's incredible to me. We'll let you go, but can you give me, are in the next 20 years, what to expect technologically?
No. No, people always ask me that, and I say, if I knew what the next big thing was, I'd be doing it.
Yeah, that's right.
One question that Brian quite often asks that I would particularly love to ask you is for a reading list. Are there books that you would recommend that people read?
Sure, all my books.
That was a great answer.
That's a good answer, baby.
And listen, there are about 10 of them, so that'll work.
Okay.
If we could see your brain, it'd be more muscular than your body, my friend. There it is. Professor Lawrence Krauss, thank you so much, man. We really appreciate it.
Sorry I came late, but it was fun.
Please, you're awesome.
Absolutely.
You're awesome. Keep thinking, man. Keep thinking.
Yeah, take care.
Bye. Thank you. Bye-bye. Hair doctor, professor.
He's awesome.
Yeah, he is awesome.
Lawrence Krauss.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, a guy who's I liked how he ended that with saying, I don't know for certain that there isn't some intelligent, you know, direction or some sort of order to this, but he wouldn't want to live in a universe without it.
But I think that's the thing is that as a scientist, you know, can you really say that God doesn't exist? No,
well,
you can't. In the same way,
what he seems to be saying is that we may very well be God. In other words, we are going to be, we're getting to a point where we will control our own direction.
We already do.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, in college, I took this class on cyborgs, monsters, and the limits of the human. It was a terrible class. I mean, you know, the reading list was, you know, you're going to watch Blade Runner. And so I was like, awesome. And then you get in there and they make you read all this psychosexual feminist Freudian theory. And it was like, not what I signed up for. But one of the points that they made that I did think was very interesting is that somebody who's wearing reading glasses is a cyborg. I mean, that's the thing. You know, the fact that you're wearing clothing, that you have like a headset on, these things make you a cyborg. Yeah. You've in some senses merged
with
technology. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So, I mean, you know, it really has already happened. And I think that's...
Yeah, I mean, eyeglasses and we're going to have computer chips in our bodies.
That's
and ultimately
right.
We're going to have, you know, biocompatible machine parts in our body.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they got one from a dick. Why do I have to ruin?
Well, Brian.
See how I ruined? I got to wrap. Rena's going to wrap it up.
Yeah, listen.
See,
you know.
I can't.
Brian, it's okay.
I can't not
it's
bring
okay.
it down to the level of an eighth grader. Lest you think this podcast is all, you know, all theoretical and mathematical and physics. I'll bring it down to my dick.
Venus.
God bless you, America. I hope you learned everything.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.